You're listening to the Matt Bubala Show, Radio 720 WGN. Happy Saturday morning to you, everybody. Well, if you've been a listener to the show over the last few years, you know there have been various points where we have brought up the mysterious case of D.B. Cooper. You remember the man back way back in the day, jumped out of a plane with a couple hundred grand, I believe it was, in cash. We'll get all the details here in a minute. We've talked about how it's the greatest mystery in aviation and something that's never been solved, or has it? There is a book out called The Last Master Outlaw, How He Outfoxed the FBI Six Times, But Not a Cold Case Team. Thomas Colbert and Tom Salazzi co-authored the book that says D.B. Cooper is alive and well. Tom joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Oh, wonderful, Matt. Thank you for having me.
The co-author, did I say the name right? Tom Salazzi?
Salazzi, like
Salazzi. Salazzi. So you and Tom have written this book, which you were telling me off the air, is basically the case that lays out, fact by fact, that D.B. Cooper is actually alive and well. You would say that definitively.
I know he's alive, and I know this is him.
Okay. Take us back for people that it's been a long time for a lot of people since they've probably heard the name D.B. Cooper. You know, it was kind of in the news last year or so ago when Mad Men finished and there was a popular theory going around that in the end he's going to end up being D.B. Cooper. That wasn't the case. And there have been other reasons from time to time, an air mystery or whatever pops up and he's back in the news. But basically, this happened so many years ago that the government, more or less, I believe you're going to tell us, gave up on it. Tell us the background. What is the story of D.B. Cooper?
Well, I was a high school going to high school in 71, and I looked at my dad's paper, and it said D.B. Cooper escaped. And I've been fascinated, as you know, kind of like our parents were fascinated with the old gangsters in the 20s. Monitored it, went to college, became a newsman at CBS, and I'd get calls about D.B. Cooper. And it was a story of a guy who was believed to be a Vietnam vet. He got in a business suit. He jumped on a plane from Portland for a short hop to Seattle in 1971. And the minute the plane was taxiing, he opened a briefcase, showed a stewardess a bomb, and said, "I want $200,000, which was worth about $1 million back in 71. I want about $200,000 and four parachutes, and I'll let the passengers go on landing." Well, they circled until they had the parachutes and the money ready. They gave him the money. They gave him the parachutes. He let all the passengers go except one stewardess and the crew, and he said, "Fly me to Mexico." He didn't say what route to take, but bottom line is when they stopped in Reno for more fuel, he was not in the back. He had jumped, apparently, out over the Northwest Forest and hasn't been seen since.
So let's...
Go ahead.
Yeah, let's get more into the detail of the actual day, because I remember we've done some other interviews on this, and I've read a little bit about this. So the original flight was just Portland to Seattle. That's probably, what, a 45-minute flight at best, right? I mean, that's a
Correct.
Short flight.
That's absolutely, less than 40 minutes.
And as soon as they're taken off, I think he or maybe it was on the second flight, he orders a drink, shows her a note, right? Does he tell her, or he hands her a note that says his demands?
He hands her a note. She assumes it's just another guy picking up on her. So
right,
she puts it away
at first. Yeah, that's right.
And he says, "No, you better read it." And that's when she reads it, passes it, and calls the pilots on a phone in the back. And that's when the hijacking and negotiations begin.
And he shows her a bomb. And what's the details of that? Did he show her truly what we know to be a bomb, or did he show her something that had some wires? And back in the 70s, when we didn't have the regulations we have today, you would think, oh, my God, he's got a bomb. And that could have, you know, today, if somebody showed you a bomb on a plane, you'd think, how'd you get a bomb on this plane? But back in the day, do we believe it really was a bomb, or he had something rigged up that made it look that way?
No, he can. First of all, anybody could walk on the plane with a briefcase and not have it looked at. There were no rules. You could walk on smoking. You can bring things with you. You could carry guns in a case.
Isn't that hilarious?
It was a different time.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So here he is with the briefcase. He opens it up. And as far as the stewardesses, who were the only ones allowed to look at it, they took it that it was serious. They weren't going to argue with this man.
Right. So he demands this. Well, they circle, and why don't they land? Why do they circle until they know they have everything he wants?
Well, he insisted they keep circling until the things were ready on the runway. This is a very shrewd Cooper. He's not going to be sitting there letting a sniper take him out through a window. So he lands quickly, refuels, gets the money, passengers off, gets the parachutes, and he's on his way.
Do we know that he had a weapon besides the bomb, or just the threat of the bomb was enough?
He
to
had
just...
no other weapon.
Okay. And do we did the bomb stay on board? Did they find it afterwards, or did his briefcase?
No.
So we don't know for sure that there was a bomb.
He
we just know
everything
he...
with him.
Okay,
everything, including the notes, the matchbook that was empty, the cigarette butts are the only thing he left.
And what about the original note he gave to the stewardess?
He took that with him.
Oh, he took it back.
He asked for it back.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's very careful.
So they land in Seattle. They refuel a little bit, right? Do they?
Well, they fill up the plane.
They fill up
completely. Remember, it was on the end of a 6-city flight.
Okay.
Flying up and down the Northwest.
Okay.
And so they wanted to fill it up. He filled it completely up. They were going to stop in Reno because there wasn't enough capacity to fly to Mexico City, which is where he had asked. And it was during that they noticed no one was in the back. He had jumped out the back staircase.
But now it wasn't just a notice that they weren't there, because I've also read that, you know, so there's a system. What type of plane was it again? It was not a DC-10. What was this called?
No,
exactly?
It's a small aircraft. I believe it was a 727. I don't have the number in my head right now.
So it's a 727, and that was a plane that had a rear exit, a rear hatch exit.
Right.
And so he deployed that in flight. He knew how to do that, and they knew that something happened in flight.
Correction, Matt, he didn't know how to do it. He had to ask. He thought there was a button in the captain's quarters.
Okay.
And when he was told by the stewardess no, she had to pull out the procedure on how to open it and read it to him. So
really?
While he had aviation skills, he didn't know how to open that door.
And so she just told him, and then he did it himself? She didn't do it for him, correct?
No, she was sent to the front. There were no windows in that door. She went up with the crew. He had a half hour in the back, and that's important. You should know, information has just been released by the FBI, there were no prints, recoverable prints, found in the Cooper area, the bathroom he used, the exit door. Even the ramps where he jumped from were smeared from top to bottom. He knew all about fingerprints. No DNA at the time. DNA wasn't considered until the late 80s.
Yeah.
So he made sure there was not one print found in that area.
So he opens up. So they're all up in the cockpit. They're flying the plane. He opens the door. And I do believe I read that they knew something happened because either some drag on the plane or a sensor goes off that door is open, right?
There was a pressure gauge that had a suction of air come in and out. When he left the stairway, that was an amount of weight on the stairway, and it caused the back door to flip up and down quickly, causing air to be pressured. And that was noticed on the dash, and they assumed at 8:04 p.m., that's when he jumped.
But he did it with enough time that they don't know for sure, giving him a wide enough swath of area he could have been that helps him on his getaway, correct?
They had a good idea where he landed because of that pressure jump, pressure gauge. They figured out where he landed. There were people that heard an aircraft, a small plane, flying at that time in the storm. It was an evening storm he jumped in. And so they have it pretty well focused on where he had landed.
Hmm. All right. So for most of us and for America, the story somewhat ends here. We've just heard little bits and pieces of hope in the years since. So this is 1971. How soon after is it? The only other things I know that have really come out since then was some money was found, like in a riverbank that they know was from that suitcase, from the money that they gave. But that was that wasn't found till a few years later, at least, or decades later, right?
It was found in 1980, and that's where my story, my research on this, began.
Okay.
Law enforcement's never believed that the family, quote-unquote, just found it on the shore. There was described a hippie family with a little boy who claimed in a news conference 4 or 5 days later they had found the money while putting a fire pit together. Nobody in law enforcement really believed that because it was not in the flight plan, a flight route. It was only a few inches down. You know, it had been 9 years, and so they were quiet about it. I had heard the rumor that no one believed it. Well, then I get a call from a cameraman in Vegas who has a network of sources in the casinos, and he's tipped there's a person that wants to get something off his chest. This is a former cocaine runner drug runner from Portland who is about to become a grandpa, and he sits him down on camera and he says, look, I'm not thrilled about 2 years of my life, but I want to tell you, my drug trafficker claimed to be Cooper in 1979 and 1980. And, of course, Rich Kashansky, my cameraman I've worked with for 20 years, was rolled his eyes, but then he said something. He said, I was at a cocaine party, and my drug trafficker for a year had been saying he was Cooper. And that party was in an apartment overlooking the Columbia River. And he pulled me aside and my co-runner, and he pointed outside, and he says, I know you don't believe I'm Cooper. I've been telling you, but I'm going to prove it to you. You see that North Shore right there? A year, in a few days, some people are going to find some of my money. And they, of course, rolled their eyes and said, sure, boss, and they headed off to a drug run. Well, they got all the way to Reno. On their way to Phoenix, they stop in a Reno hotel. They turn on the tube 5 days later, and there is that hippie couple that the drug runner had pointed out at his party, saying they are the ones that are going to find it. And what do you know, 5 days later, they're on TV with their boy. Now, let me tell you, that's when I grabbed my notebook. Because when my cameraman told me this story, it answered the question of all those cops years ago. This might explain how it got there. I spent 8 months investigating this drug trafficker. First, I learned a few months after that occasion, after this alleged planting of the money, the drug trafficker dies in a mysterious one-car crash in Portland. Then we find out after 8 months, accidentally, that our trafficker had a partner, a secret 7-year partner who happened to be a Vietnam veteran, special forces trained, and worked with him on all sorts of crime. And he was a one-time D.B. Cooper suspect by the name of Robert W. Rackstraw. And your listeners can read all about him, see him on camera. We confront him on camera with former FBI armed in San Diego, where he now lives. He's a former university head of a department, a arbitration expert, and now he's retired, living and has a boat, 45-foot yacht, down in San Diego, pointed at Mexico, 7 miles away. And you'll love this. The name of the boat? Poverty Sucks. I'm not making this up. I am not making this up. And we put together a cold case team, 40 members, 23 of them are feds, 12 of them former FBI, and for the last 6 years, we've been following his trail all over the country for 45 years. We have 102 pieces of evidence, including DNA. We brought it to the FBI with his former mentors and trainers from their own department. They refused to meet with us. They had planned for years to meet with us. But when they heard we had a strong circumstantial case, it was told to us that they are fearful of a circumstantial case after 45 years. And you can understand, Matt, DNA might be corrupted, the older witnesses won't hold up. Well, let me tell you, we gathered our evidence with those things in mind. We have fantastic witnesses. We have great forensics. In fact, we have 12 of his former family members, two ex-wives, a getaway girl he flew away with on other escapes. This is an incredible story. And the book that we spoke of, The Last Master Outlaw, the reason we have this book is not only because of the cold case team. It's because six of his women turned him in. And they're the stars in this book.
So you're saying Rackstraw's ex-wives tell you, yeah, he's the guy.
They believe he's the guy, yeah. But I will tell you he is because of the forensics and everything we have.
All right.
Well, we believe he shared it with his third wife, who he now lives with. But the other two wives were kept in the, and we believe the first wife knows. But the middle wife, who's done a lot of talking, she can only say, I now believe it's him. It's a fascinating story. It's solid. We have so many different sources of information. We have letter trails that he, you know, there were four famous D.B. Cooper letters mailed right after the jump.
All right, hold on one second, Tom.
Sure.
Because I got to take a quick break, and I want to keep getting into this. I didn't know there were four letters. I don't know a lot of this. I think America doesn't know a lot of this. So let's get more into it. The book is called The Last Master Outlaw, How He Outfoxed the FBI Six Times, But Not a Cold Case Team, Not Thomas Colbert's Cold Case Team. You can buy the book and read more at dbcooper.com. We'll have more with Tom next here on WGN Radio. The Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. We're speaking with Thomas Colbert, who along with his co-author wrote The Last Master Outlaw. It's about D.B. Cooper, who Tom says is alive and living in San Diego with his yacht pointed at Mexico. And I guess the intimation there is if things get too hot, he can always jump on and go.
Well, I would tell you he's now 73. He is quite a, he has a lot of medals from Vietnam, special forces training, and so forth. But time's caught up with him. In fact, we confronted him in 2013 with some of my cold case members, former FBI. And let me tell you, if your fans want to go up on dbcooper.com, they can watch 3.5 minutes of the confrontation. He puts his foot in his mouth a few times. A few months after that, he had a heart attack and stroke. He now carries a pacemaker, they claim. So I don't think he's going to jump in a boat and head somewhere. He's a happy grandpa with, I think, 13 grandkids, six kids, and semi-retired with a little boat shop. Let me tell you, the cold case team's on his mind every day.
All right, so let's go back to it actually happening. So he gets away, he gets out of the plane lands, nobody on board. The name D.B. Cooper was kind of an accident,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Dan Cooper is how he signed his ticket.
Okay.
How he signed his boarding pass. But when they were looking for him, I guess the authorities thought, let's first eliminate all the Coopers out there, thinking a guy would use his real name. So reporters, AP and UPI, both claim to have overheard the cops say, hey, who are we going to go see next at the police station? And somebody yelled out, a D.B. Cooper.
Hmm.
And that name stuck.
Okay. So it stuck as D.B. Cooper. What, now, in your research of Rackstraw,
mm-hmm,
was there any reason to tie in? Did Dan Cooper make sense in some way? Did you say, aha,
oh, yeah,
this is why he used it?
Well, right, look, Dan, our guy Rackstraw was in trouble in California, and that's how we heard about him. He had several other arrests, check kiting, fraud, hoarding explosives, stealing a small plane. I mean, this is a bad cat. This is no folk hero. And in the middle of all that, he was in jail. And he winds up calling a TV station one day, and he tells them, I'm Cooper. And the man who answers the phone, a renowned newsman in Los Angeles, says, prove it. And he says, well, I'm in jail here up in Stockton, California, but I will tell you, I took the name Cooper in honor of my uncle, Ed Cooper, in Phoenix, who had jumped over 2,000 times. And as a teen, I just fell in love with what he does. And their researchers tracked down the Ed Cooper, and he confirmed, yeah, that's my nephew. What is he up to now? He had no idea about the D.B. Cooper jump, but he wasn't happy to hear his name was used in honor.
All right, so if Cooper is telling his drug buddies, yeah, I'm the guy, I'll prove it to you, somebody's going to find money, or he's calling TV stations, if he's doing all these things, why doesn't he ever completely out himself?
Well, first of all, remember, the man saying he's Cooper and hiding money on the shore is actually his drug trafficker partner, Dick Riggs.
Okay, I thought you were going to tell me that the death was faked, but no.
No, that was a real death,
okay,
and nobody knows how he died. There are a lot of theories, but bottom line is, these two men, when Rackstraw was facing jail time in California, 1 to 2 years, he escapes other times. He, in fact, becomes a fugitive on planes twice more, and one of those trips was back to Portland, and that was when he traveled in Portland as a fugitive. He was out for 4 months. He got on a motorcycle and he met with Dick Briggs and handed him, we believe, the $5,800 to plant on the shore. That was 4 months before those two runners I told you about, the drug runners, claimed and were told their boss was Cooper. The real Cooper, we believe, handed him the money. And a year later, when Rackstraw's in jail in California, The money is planted. The FBI announces on the shore, well, apparently, Cooper drowned. This is a very interesting scheme. When that was announced, obviously, Rackstraw was cleared in jail, and he walked out of jail a year later.
But why does
under his own name.
Why does he call a TV station, though? Why does he do little things like that you would think would keep alive the thought that maybe he is out there, or maybe this guy is him?
Well, let me tell you something. Our man has been, I don't want to say diagnosed, but has been documented by judges, co-workers, and family members as a narcissistic sociopath. And that's documented in the book, that this guy loves the attention. But at the same time, he is very careful in front of media cameras and elsewhere about admitting who he is. He has admitted to certain friends. He has teased reporters, I might be. He sat down on camera with that TV station in Los Angeles twice, and they asked him, are you Cooper? And he said, I could have been. And he plays with them. And that's what he's very, very good at. As I said, he's a genius off the scales, and he's been playing people for a long time. But as I said, we have the evidence that proves who he is, and the book, it's awfully hard to lay out here on radio, but
sure.
I think you'll have more fun on the website. It has quite a bit of information there.
The book is The Last Master Outlaw. We've got to take a quick break for the news, but Thomas, I want to get a little bit more into the letters and everything else and the confrontations of him, what else you have done over these years as you've researched him. Again, the book is called The Last Master Outlaw. You can find more at dbcooper.com. You can order the book and see the videos and everything else these guys have been doing. Thomas J. Colbert will be with us again after the news. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN.
Made up my mind, make a new start. Going to California with an aching in my heart.
Welcome back in. It's the Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. Thomas Colbert, the author, co-author of The Last Master Outlaw, how he outfoxed the FBI six times but not a cold case team. We're talking about the legendary D.B. Cooper. Tom says he is alive, maybe not so well. He's how old these days?
73.
His name is it Bob Rackstraw?
He goes by Bob Rackstraw, yes.
Is that his real name, or is this another possible?
His real name is Robert W. Rackstraw, or Bob. He was known in the Army as Airborne Bob. He uses Airborne Bob on Facebook and in emails. Your listeners can find that. And he's as I said, he's had a lot of approaches since our documentary came out last year.
So why does he not just fess up? Is there still, I imagine the statute has not, on this type of crime, there's no statute of limitations, he could still be arrested?
It used to be a capital offense to hijack a plane. That was taken down, and that made it a five-year crime. So here, all these years later, what they did just before the end of that first 5 years, after it was no longer a capital crime, is a federal grand jury got together and gave it a John Doe indictment. That means whenever a John Doe is identified as Cooper, the 5 years can kick back in. About half those cases have been thrown out by the Supreme Court, but the other half have stuck. So the DOJ is taking a risk and a chance that law is going to hold up someday. Frankly, I don't think they're going to prosecute him anymore. And in fact, that's why they backed out of our prosecution. They told us they're fearful of a circumstantial case.
Off the record, did they tell you they believe you actually have the guy, or do they not think you actually have the guy?
Well, the FBI is not showing, the actual FBI are not showing their cards, but we have a half dozen former FBI on our team. We have an FBI assistant director who was a liaison on the documentary, who in fact told us that he thinks it's a 9 out of 10. He believes it could be. But because the FBI is fearful of a circumstantial case, they won't look at our evidence, and that's why I'm in federal court next month with my cold case team and attorneys suing the FBI and DOJ to reopen the case.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
we've already had two hearings, just stay tuned. We'll be in Washington.
You know, Tom, there's a new sheriff in town, and a certain well-placed tweet at the right time could actually make somebody say, hey, let's figure this out. You know, yeah. That could happen
for him. He's very in tune to media, so it'll be very interesting if he sees this as an opportunity, again, talking about sociopaths. some of our best presidents have been sociopaths, and who knows? This man may claim this for his own, but hey, look, bottom line is we're here not for fame and fortune. My wife and I have funded this whole thing. And have worked hard to get the truth out, and that's what we're about, getting the truth. This is not our first case that we've worked on.
Well, why is that, Tom? Why the fascination with this case? You said you're spending your own money. You've spent years and years, hopefully not taking away from the rest of your life, but this has become certainly your passion. Why work so hard on this?
Well, Matt, like a lot of good DJs out there and radio hosts, you're passionate about communicating. And I've been, as I said, a former senior researcher at the CBS News station in Los Angeles for 10 years, then Paramount as a story editor. I believe in true stories. This is my 21st true story for the big or small screen. And we're excited to be involved in history, and this is how we do it.
So the documentary came out last year on the History Channel, or where did it appear?
Came out on the History Channel. Little interesting fact for you. 18 of the 102 pieces of evidence were cut from the documentary, and they happened to be the strongest pieces of evidence. We're still puzzled why History Channel cut them out. A lot of my FBI guys think they did it to match the narrative of the show. The FBI had called the show with the program, D.B. Cooper, Case Closed. And those 18 pieces of evidence, of course, are part now of our court case.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. So let's go back to after it happens. Four letters you mentioned earlier are sent. What are these four letters?
Fascinating four letters were sent right after, all within 5 days. What's interesting about the letters is that three of the four were cut and pasted like the Zodiac Killer, words from other newspapers and magazines. They were sent, the first and last were sent from Northern California to the Reno paper. The second one, he actually mailed it from Vancouver, B.C. He was there for the Grey Cup game, their Super Bowl. And he even said it in his note, you can't find me, I'm here at the Grey Cup game. And the third letter was mailed from Oregon, Portland, Oregon itself, and that was mailed to the Oregonian. What I didn't tell you is the first and last letters we discovered by their post office markings were mailed within 30 to 50 miles of Mr. Rackstraw's home with his folks, where he lived for the next year and a half, in the foothills of the High Sierras in a little town of 1,500 people, 500 miles from the crime scene. Now, my former FBI that looked at the letter trail and saw that the first and last were mailed from a remote part of California woods said, that's an 8 out of 10. You've just put the trail in on D.B. Cooper, they felt. Those letters were saved by the original agents. They believed there was some truth to them. And I will tell you, the FBI still has the first and last letters I told you about, the most valuable ones near Rackstraw. They didn't even know Rackstraw was living there. And they're still holding on to the letters. We believe they have some DNA on those letters. And we want to compare it to DNA we have of Rackstraw. But again, we're going to have to sue them to make them look at it.
How does the handwriting compare to Rackstraw, as you found in the rest of his life, to these letters?
Well, that's an interesting statement. We're this man has had 27 different fake identities. He's used in 5 countries. And the most interesting one is after he was kicked out of the Army in June of 71, where did he head? He headed to the Northwest and then vanished. Right when he vanished, an interesting character appeared by the name of Norman D. Winter, a Swiss chalet owner who's walking America. This was 1971, walking America. Well, we absolutely believe Mr. Norman D. Winter is Mr. Rackstraw. Now, we know that because we have 15 witnesses in their 60s and 70s that have been shown old video. Remember the station I told you he sat down with 8 years later. And we have photos of him in the Army and, of course, the sketches. Our team when they looked at the D.B. Cooper sketch number 2, which is the darker skinned one your clients will see, your listeners will see on the website, they say there are 9 points of match on his face and the sketch. Judges will go after people or give a court order on 3 matches. You'll be fascinated to see how close they are. But the video is what really knocked it out of the park for our witnesses. They said that's the way he looked down. That's his voice. That's Norman D. Winter. I know it's him. Well, you mentioned letters. Norman D. Winter sent 7 letters to most of those people, back and forth to his targets. He was a grifter. He was borrowing thousands of dollars. He would show up at night. During the day, we believe he had a small stolen plane, and he was flying and monitoring the airline flights. That's how he divided his day, as Rackstraw during the day, looking for the flights and potential D.B. Cooper, and at night he'd be Norman D. Winter. Those letters we are comparing right now to 12 pages of jail letters, appeals letters, divorce documents that we have of Mr. Rackstraw. They are in the hands of a former FBI document forensic expert. We hope to hear from him in a few days. I will tell you, my non-professional cold case members that are not forensic document experts look at it and say it's an absolute match between the two people, Norman D. Winter and Bob Rackstraw. And I'll end it with telling you quickly, there is one expert who is an active cop in South Carolina on our team who's anonymous because he's still working, told us. He said, you know, let me get this straight. You've got 3 master criminals in the Northwest. You got Mr. Rackstraw, who's up there and documented as a con artist and a master criminal and kicked out of the military. You've got Norman D. Winter, who is also a pilot, who also is a master criminal. And you have D.B. Cooper, another aviation expert, a jumper, and a master criminal. All of them, according to witnesses, look like Mr. Rackstraw. And whenever one of them vanished, when Norman vanished, Rackstraw would appear at his parents' home in California. When he left the parents, Norman D. Winter would appear. When Norman D. Winter vanished on the night before the jump, what do you know? A man named Dan Cooper shows up in line. Now, here's the end point on those letters. Remember I mentioned 3 of the 4 were cut and pasted?
Right.
The one written, the one in Vancouver, B.C., was hand-printed. My wife and I are looking at that letter because the newspaper was smart enough to take a picture of it back in 71. We're looking at the letter, and the letters appear to match the 9 letters of Dan Cooper on the airline ticket. We hire the best forensic document expert we could find a couple years ago, former president of the International Association, highly recommended. And Linton Mohammed is his name from San Francisco. He's done over 100 American cases. And he looks at the letter printing and the ticket. He says there are similarities, and it appears to be written by one writer. So, if you believe all 4 D.B. Cooper letters, beginning and ending near Rackstraw's house, were written by Mr. Rackstraw, that handprinting puts our man on the ticket line.
We only have a couple of minutes left, Tom. There's so much more we could do here. The book is called The Last Master Outlaw. Will you make a documentary yourself that has all of the information? Will there be something else that we can see? What's next besides the court cases?
If there's no court case, if they pass on prosecuting, we've already put the book out. We've already put the documentary out until we were bushwhacked at the end.
Yeah.
I have a producer partner in Hollywood, and we're developing a program called The Trial of D.B. Cooper. And what we're hoping to do is get a real-life TV judge, get our cold case team on the stand, have a man acting as Rackstraw in the seat, and the jury will be the greatest jury in the land, social media. We'll let the American public watch the show and decide if Mr. Rackstraw is Cooper or not.
Well, instead of getting an actor, you ought to invite Mr. Rackstraw to go in and be part of it. He seems to like the cat and mouse game a little bit.
He's very afraid of us these days.
Well, what's your guess, Tom, on what happens? I think you sounds like you're guessing that the government doesn't want to touch this because they don't want to look bad if they can't get the prosecution. Is your guess that it's not until after Mr. Rackstraw passes someday that we find out the truth, or that he takes the truth to the grave with him?
I think, you know, it's hard to negotiate with a sociopath, a narcissistic sociopath. It's all about them. And so we also, there are some theories by my former FBI guys that maybe he's fearful because he's killed people. He was arrested and found not guilty of killing his own father. But let me tell you, we got an interview with a sister who absolutely believes he did. We have crime partners that say, we know he killed him. Well, he got off through his tricks and trades in the trial. There are some people believe the reason he won't turn himself in is he's probably killed other people. But I'm not speculating on that. That's going to be up to the authorities.
And that's why he wouldn't turn himself in, just because something else might come out that does get him in trouble, that he wouldn't be able to just enjoy the glory of being outed as D.B. Cooper.
Somebody might say, you know, that jerk, I'm going to turn him in. You know, and that's, again, that's speculation. Bottom line is, we just got to tell the story. I really appreciate, Matt, your time in allowing me this this soapbox to get this out.
Well, Tom, we'd love to chat again after we have the court cases, and as things move on, let's check in again. Again, the book, The Last Master Outlaw, find it and more information at dbcooper.com. Thomas Colbert, thank you so much for jumping on the phone.
You're welcome, Matt.
I got to admit, it's a story that has really always fascinated me, and it's just amazing to think that maybe the guy's actually just living in California and got away with it all these years. I wonder if it's going to be like a deep throat thing that we'll find out near the end, or maybe we never will. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN.